You're listening to Leicester Build Back Better Stories. Conversations about how communities across Leicester are planning for change following the pandemic. Over six programmes, we'll hear from people at the forefront of civic society in Leicester, and we'll find out how they are planning to do things differently in response to Leicester's extended lockdown. For further information about each of the topics covered in the programmes and extended versions of the conversations, go to the Leicester Stories website, leicesterstories.uk. Returning to normal after the pandemic means looking at the big things that enable communities to thrive, but also the small things, such as the relationships that we have with one another. I'm Rob Watson, and I've been chatting over the summer with people who work for charities and civic society organisations in Leicester about what they think building back better means and what we need to do to be ready to face the next set of social and personal dilemmas. Over six programmes, we're hearing from people across Leicester who've been telling us what they think about the city and in what way they think life in Leicester can be improved. In this third episode, we'll hear from Dr. Marie Lefebvre, a project worker at Quetzal who helped women recover from childhood sexual violence, and from Makinda Chahal, a senior support worker at Trade Sexual Health, which is dedicated to preventing the spread and reducing the stigma of HIV. To start this discussion off, Leicester Stories community reporter Ryan Clayton has been out talking to people about what they think of Leicester and how they think it might need to change after the lockdown.
Yeah, have you heard the slogan before, Build Back Better?
This is the first time I've ever heard it.
So if you saw it on social media, Twitter, Instagram, whatever, Build Back Better, what would you think it might mean?
I guess it's implying trying to get not just back where we were before, but in a better place than we were before the whole coronavirus situation. I mean, I think everything, obviously society has its kind of problems anyway, so I think before coronavirus everything was kind of ticking along fine. I think if we can just get to a place where we were as close to we were beforehand, I think everyone will actually just appreciate that more now than we did before. Like, you don't know what you've got until it's gone, and now we've had all these restrictions. I think even though people complained and maybe they didn't enjoy their lives quite so much, if everything just got back to the way it was, I think everyone would be in mentally a much better place.
So we're just walking around and asking people about coronavirus and the Build Back Better slogan. Have you heard it before?
No, I haven't.
No. If you saw that on social media, on Twitter, Facebook, what might you think it means?
Bouncing back better, like from COVID.
Yeah, to kind of help our society and bring it back up.
Yeah. Is there anything about Leicester or England in general you'd like to see improved?
I hope we carry on social distancing, to be honest.
Yes. I think that was a good shout, and I would like to continue that. But I think the music industry and like the venues around, I feel like they suffered one of the most biggest losses, so it will be good to see them being rebuilt and people actually going out and enjoying themselves and listening to some live music.
Yeah. So you want more money pumped into those?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Not just sports, but also live music, especially because you couldn't go anywhere. I know the festivals are starting to roll out, but still, I feel like a lot of people suffered and a lot of people just lost their jobs. So it will be good to see some changes.
Anything we need? Well, I think they're a bit slow in coming forward with the, for instance, the park down the bottom. Mm. Yeah, I think there'd been an idea to put a swimming pool there.
Oh, right.
Yeah, at Coventry, one in the middle of the town. Mm. They've got a park across the road. They've put another, paid millions of pounds for another park there, silly.
Yeah.
Silly, stupid. I think it would have been a good idea, that would have been. A nice swimming pool there and waste money. They've ruined the market. Leicester market's gone. Yeah, that was the biggest market in the country, but not now. They've messed around with that. I didn't agree with that. But.
You're right, guys. I don't suppose you've got a moment to answer some questions.
Sorry, mate. No,
it's all right. Cheers.
I love Leicester. It's a great place.
What was the question again? Sorry.
Just how do you feel about the city?
Yeah, it's a great city. It's nice. It's a nice size. Not too big, not too little. Got a lot of history behind it, and obviously the Foxes as well. So, brilliant. Good sport. Good sporting teams.
Is there anything about the city that makes it feel unique to you when you think about Leicester?
Just probably like the experiences I've had at uni here and stuff like that. Yeah. The people I've met along the way. things like that.
It's very multicultural as well, yeah, which I like. Just all around great city. Yeah.
Is there anything, anywhere you can go, anything you do that makes it feel like home to you, gives you a sense of belonging or community?
The pub.
Events. Yeah. I like the events in Leicester.
Good events,
actually. I like the events.
Like music events.
Good selection as well, aren't they?
Yeah. Bit of everything. But yeah.
It's about it, really.
Hi, my name is Mary. I work for Quetzal. Quetzal is a charity in Leicester supporting female survivors of childhood sexual abuse. At Quetzal, I've got two roles. I'm a project facilitator for the Breaking the Silence Initiative, a project that aims to measure the effectiveness of a community-based approach to raise awareness in South Asian communities in Leicester. On my second role, I'm a development officer, so I support with monitoring, reporting, developing funding application to funders. On a day-to-day basis, my role as a project facilitator involved engaging with different communities, developing partnership, so we can pretty much co-create together experiences that will support communities to think how Quetzal exists, how there is different services that exist in Leicester that could support me with my mental health or support me to better regulate my emotion. So, for example, one of the things we did recently, I collaborated with Lightseekers, a community art organization that engage people in activities, and we decided to organize a 9 online session program called Ways to Wellbeing, pretty much targeting Leicester as a whole community, and invited different collaborators to come through, including Quetzal. And Quetzal did a session about emotional regulation. So, you know, Quetzal, then my aim is to support female survivors, but through this project, we wanted to provide the tools to communities in Leicester so that they can better manage their emotion, regulate and stabilize, especially if they are feeling traumatized at a certain point in time. So yes, my role is really to create connection and identify in the community what are the gifts, the talent, the resources that we can tap into and mobilize to raise awareness about Quetzal services on what it is to be a trauma-informed community through the different knowledge and information that we can share with them. And communities got many individuals amazing gifts, so why not make that flourish? So yes, Quetzal's main mission is to support survivors of childhood sexual abuse in their journey towards recovery from the trauma of childhood sexual abuse. We support female survivors aged 16 and above living in Leicester, Leicestershire and Rutland. We provide predominantly free counselling up to a year to female survivors. We are able to do that through volunteer counsellors and trainee placement counsellors. And then the second part of that, supporting female survivors is also supporting all the people around them to understand their needs, understand what are the impact of abuse on adult survivors, how it impact their behaviors, how it impact their day-to-day life, and it include their family and their direct community. And so our work is to develop resources to get this wider community aware of their needs, but aware of their stories as well. I think female survivors in their journey towards recovery, they are committed to change, and that's why they come to Quetzal. On sometimes in the most creative way, we did find during the pandemic that some female survivors needed, you know, they couldn't come face to face, so they had to do the counseling on the phone. And sometimes, very creatively, they had to do their counseling in their cars or at the neighbors or on the step of their house. They are very committed. So it is our role as Quetzal to amplify their voice so that communities are aware and empathize and support them or find creative way to support them too. So yes, this is our at the back of that we support them in their journey by sharing their story. I was aware of Building Back Better, and yet I was not involved in the conversation on what it would entail. And I kind of like went back into the literature, and I was like, oh, Building Back Better, what does that mean? And I was like, oh, it's a strategy to support that aim to revitalize infrastructure and social system after a disaster. So this is what I read about. And then I do remember the conversation, and yet I was not involved in the conversation as such. And in the last 18 months, my main focus was to create awareness and ensure that we create the connection with our female survivors, so that they know that regardless of the disaster that we're experiencing, we are still here to support them. So my main focus was around connection. And then how do we ensure that the information is transmitted to the community, especially when the most low-tech technology is not accessible, which is word of mouth. It's kind of accessible, but yet, you know, we do not have the opportunity to go in places where communities meet as with the same ease as before because of fear, stress, and the lockdown restrictions that were put in place. So, and then the other thing was to stabilize people, taking care of their mental health, and especially the community of Quetzal, which is their volunteers, and the people we are involved with, to ensure that they are okay. So this was our main focus. We weren't even focusing too much about what's after the pandemic as such. We are focused about what infrastructure that we can put together quickly to support people in this period of crisis. And I guess were we already in the process of building better, because actually a lot of the things that we put in place during the pandemic, such as online counseling, telephone counseling, all the training that we provided online as opposed to face-to-face to all our volunteers, connectors on community connectors and volunteer counselor, on all the Zoom meetings that we were able to do, the CRM system that we put in place during the pandemic, all those tools are still being used as of today. So maybe we were already in that process of building back better, on having relation, on creating events in a different ways to bring people together, so co-creating together experiences that keep people safe, that does not require meeting up together. On those are things we did. We really use our platform to tell stories by writing articles, and then the volunteer community connectors were amplifying those stories using social media by using their own creativity to create content. And we were collaborating with people to develop program, organizing awareness raising sessions and things. Obviously, the opportunity to co-create face-to-face was not as available. But it gave us the chance to think more about what it would be like. So for me, building back better in that sense during the pandemic was like, where can people meet together that will be safe? And it included community gardening, engaging with the conservation volunteers that support community gardens throughout Leicester, and engage with communities interested in gardening that are not defined by ethnicity or, you know, all those different elements, but are interested just being outside and getting together. And yeah, Quite Solid is an organization supporting female survivors of childhood sexual abuse. We can garden, we can get together with people, and we can do outside. So now we collaborate. We've been collaborating in engaging communities in that sense. So yeah, changing our approach. And I think maybe there is an element of building back better, thinking about, you know, some of the goal of Leicestershire County Council, which is not only about healthier communities, is also about sustainability and the environment. Maybe we should spend more time outside. and this is what we're going to try to do as much as we can. So yes, it gave us the time to pause and really think about the different type of events. Events are so important in the sense that they are the opportunity to bring people together to share information as quickly as possible in a space of 2 hours, and then dispatch and share this information wherever they need to share it. And so, yes, how can we recreate those experiences and get together again, and really start to think about what we can do after the pandemic in terms of, you know, obviously exhibition, theatre. I always think theatre are a beautiful place for people to get together. Training is a form of theatre. People get together, you've got someone presenting work on people sitting, an audience listening to it. How can we tour our training across Leicester, inside or outside, for people to get together and share information? So it gave us really an opportunity to think and plan and be less reactive. I think in the charity sector there is this element of we are very reactive to the funding that are coming towards us. But for me, at Quetzal, what the work what we're trying to do is really to be more proactive in our approach, in the way we're engaging with communities, by developing an array of experiences co-created with our partners that are genuinely thought through. You know, like an exhibition, we are organizing an exhibition at Quetzal on the 18th of September. And I thought to myself, okay, it's probably the first time that people are going to come back to the building. What can we bring together? So I thought University of Leicester could be there. Female survivors who are painting could be there. Other partners and the volunteers could create something and bring that together. But this gift that we're creating at Quetzal, it needs to be shown to more people. So how can I bring other communities, galleries, community centers to be like, okay, we're going to invite this invitation to tour and to have a walk through the city. So this is, you know, it's part of this journey of being more proactive in our approach in furthering our connection with communities by ensuring that the product or those experiences that we create do not stay static, but actually have a life on their own. So, yes. The feelings when we had conversation about, you know, being more strategic or proactive in our approach, in engaging with communities, on being more kind of planning the way we develop experiences or events and resources. There were definitely this conversation about funding. Just ring the bell. You know, how can we get funding that support us to actually develop program and resources, and we can just ongoingly, you know, just develop the work. At Quetzal, my role as the Breaking the Silence Initiative is finishing in February 2022. So we are already thinking about, you know, what is the next project? What can we do next? For me to be able to stay within the organization and develop further the work. And it's not only about me, it's about how can we invite other people to take part of the journey, because I really think with any project, it's important to let them go and get new people in to to bring their own energy in it. You know, I would love someone else to take on the focus of supporting female survivors, South Asian female survivors, to give a new flavor to the project. So the conversation was really around funding on one hand, and how do we align our resources with partners, or collaborators, I would like to say, because there's a difference between collaboration and partnership. I think, how can we agree on a program of event when collaborators can ensure that they plan their resources in order to come at Quetzal and deliver whatever they want to deliver when we've got a bit more space. So yes, there is a lot of question about funding on developing application that allow us to build on what we've created and keep on going on things. So this was kind of the main conversation, and I think there is still a lot of, well, we cannot really plan ahead because so and so and so. But my feeling, and I think the conversation will continue, I don't think it's true. I think that there is opportunities with all the gifts and talents and competencies of people we've got around us, all the communities that we've been able to gather around us. I think through the project, I've probably connected between 150 and 200 people, and probably more because of the social media impact. Where can we find resources or little pot of fundings to create new projects? They are there. You know, recently, a month ago, sorry, someone dropped on my desk a 43-page play, a script of this person wrote a script about childhood sexual abuse and recovery and why not. I've got a play. The curve is there. I engaged with them and I said, I've got a play. Please help me. Help me to produce it. There's resources in Leicester. We've got a very creative community, and we've got people who knows, who find the funding, who find the resources. So why not find a way to pull those resources to create something absolutely incredible? And I don't need much. All I need is probably one event a month from different partners, on one production from Quetzal once a year that I'm able to tour. If the performing arts sector are able to do it, why not Quetzal? This is my point, you know, because training, supporting people in Leicester to become more trauma-informed, we can do it through leaflets, we can do it through training, we can do it through Zoom now, which is a great resource, we can do it through social media, and I think our volunteer community connectors done an amazing job in developing resources in that regard. We can do it through podcast. If I have to develop every year a different training program that we have to tour in Leicester, I will do it. And we will find the funding to do so, and we will make it happen. And then if we can get some extra funding just to support other partners to share their knowledge for Quetzal community, we'll find a way. And I don't think this is inaccessible. And I think it's about us communicating with funders, especially in the... it's about communicating and developing this relationship of trust with funders for them to understand, you know, the vision on what we're trying to achieve. And I think there are, you know, we had some fantastic funders. Comic Relief have been incredible and supportive. And Leicestershire County Council and Shire and Sharnwood, they are, and I'm sure it is feasible for us to create this vision on we've seen amazing other examples. Leicestershire Care is on there. They're doing amazing work on a lot of our other partners. So it's not inaccessible. So this conversation came along a lot. But you know, Quetzal, we've been here for 30 years. And we've never really needed in the past to be front-facing is really through the Breaking the Silence initiative that we started this process of engaging more with the communities on amplifying the stories of survivors of childhood sexual abuse through the small animation that we've created recently on all the awareness raising programs that I've done. So it's kind of like, you know, changing and transforming on learning from best practices elsewhere, on bringing that with the organization, on changing the culture within the organization. And it is happening. And I've got no worries whatsoever that everything that we aim to achieve is going to be achieved, as long as we keep in mind that it's about stories, it's about the dialogue and the exchange that we've got with people, and we need to create space for those exchange to happen through event, through podcast, through radio interviews, through press releases on event, and really bringing forth the gift of people, you know. I support 6 volunteer community connectors. They are all very different from one another. I had one who is very interested in gardening, and that's why within the community garden, a mobilizer to engage with the community garden. I've got one who is interested in organizing an event on litter picking. What does he have to do with Quetzal? He has everything to do with Quetzal. Enhancing your environment to support your mental health is very important for anyone to engage with. So she's organizing an event with DMU University, raising awareness about some of the services supporting survivors of abuse. But she's doing it in a soft way by just picking litters within the Westcott area. I've got another one who lives in Belgrave, and she wants to engage more with the Belgrave community. I'm going to meet her later to knock on someone's door to ask if it's okay to paint on their house, because we want to create a mural with some students in Leicester. Just a beautiful mural that express how connected Leicester community is and supportive they are of survivors of abuse, or women and men, of people in general. Is that true? Is that true or not? We're just pointing to the truth. On inviting people to join that truth, I think, and we do that through those experiences, and we will continue to do so.
You're listening to Leicester Builds Back Better Stories, conversations about how communities across Leicester are planning for change following the pandemic. For further information about each of the topics covered in the programmes and extended versions of the conversations, go to Leicester Stories website, leicesterstories.uk.
Things that can be improved. I don't know, you know, I don't know. Maybe like homeless people need to, like, I don't know, not be so, like, I ain't got nothing against them or anything like that. I'm just trying to make some money, but why would you sleep in a doorway? I'm sure there's plenty of better places to sleep, you know what I mean? Like, just wake up and they're like at work or something, you know what I mean?
Leicester City, you want me to be honest?
Absolutely.
I've lived here over 50 years and I've never been so disappointed and ashamed to tell people I live here. Mm. It's gone down big time, honestly. I know we're multicultural, but honestly, it used to be so lovely. I've just come down, I don't know what you call that street, can't think what you call it. And it was so lovely. It used to be nice to put all new paving slabs and everything. You want to see the filth from the takeaway shops, you know, the food shops. There's grease everywhere. It's so filthy. Honestly, they sit and they eat food here and there's bins there, but they'll throw the rubbish down where they're sitting. Oh, it's awful, but you look how many bins. You go, there's a bin there, you walk, 15 yards, and there's another bin. There's another bin there, another one up. They're too idle to get up and do it. I don't know, you can't say it's English, you can't say it's just a multitude of everybody. It used to be so lovely. I brought my children by when I got to up in Leicester, and we had a good life. The old Leicester, you wouldn't know, of course, but the old Leicester was beautiful. We had a lot of old buildings. We've got nothing. We've not even got any ladies' shops. We've got nothing. All the men's shops have gone. You know, the individual. Everything's online. And what few shops you've got.
I mean, a lot of things actually have improved in the past couple of years after winning the Premier League trophy, yeah. But I do feel like Leicester's evolved from where it was. Obviously, winning the FA Cup right now and Community Shield, yeah. I'm like a big football fan, yeah. So after winning all of that, yeah, people around the world know what Leicester is about. And we have the potential of growing and going up around the world as well. I know people chanting Leicester's name all around the world because they know about this small club, and going from small place and going in that actually around the world is a big thing, a big achievement. That's what I say. And point of view from football, yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
But in general, Leicester obviously still needs development in such areas as obviously city centre. If you go other places, other, like if you go Birmingham, Coventry, yeah, they're quite small like area. Obviously Coventry, not Birmingham, but they are more of like modernised or something. Over here, people tend to still, I don't know, having that, what's this called, upside down lifestyle. I don't know why.
I don't know.
Yes, I just still feel like that. But yeah, Leicester is actually nice. Yeah, especially nightlife. Yeah, definitely.
I was just walking around and I'm asking people about the city and about, how do you feel about Leicester?
I love Leicester. It's my home.
Yeah.
So I did move away and I missed it. So I came back. It's so historic. I mean, Leicester is a historic city. I think the cathedral is number one spot. Newark Museum, there's loads of places to go. There's so many. There's Jury Wall Museum. There's so many museums here. So, yeah, there's plenty of places. But what makes me feel at home, when I come into the city centre, I grew up here. So it's like I meet people here from my childhood. So it's home. It's Leicester. Because I grew up here, and I'm 52 now, so I've been here like all my life. I have seen the changes. Some of them I don't like. Some of the changes I don't like, where's Woolworths? Where's C&A? You know, Lewis's? You know, all the good old shops. I miss that. I'd like to see them back, but that's not going to happen.
I love Leicester. I've been away most of the time. I've come back in April after 14 years in London. And I just love Leicester. It's full of history. It's fantastic, actually. Every corner you turn, you find something new.
Is there anything about the city that brought you back, that made it feel unique to you?
It's the family city. It's my family are here. But being a big Leicester City fan as well, you've got to come back for that. But I've got a home here, and I've had the home here for 15 years or so. So I was always destined to come back.
Is there anything about the city that does make it feel like home for you, like maybe the football? Or?
Well, the football, obviously. Some of the people are really good. I find Leicester people very open and friendly, as a rule. There's parts of the city I don't like, mainly because you've got to blame our fathers for this, the council, where they knocked all the historic buildings down and built concrete in its place. Most cities you go to nowadays have kept their old historic buildings, but Leicester unfortunately didn't. But I love Leicester. I like the pedestrian areas. I understand they're trying to get the cars out of the vehicle, but I'm a car driver. So as long as there's plenty of parking spaces on the outside, I don't mind at all. It's when they make the parking very difficult. They say go on the buses, but I live out in the country and the bus service is not very good. So I'm almost forced to use my car. That's the only thing, really. Improve the transport links for us. Have a tram. Do what Nottingham and other cities have done. Have a tram. Yeah, we need a tram. We need a tram.
So my name is Mukinder Chahal. I'm the Senior Health Promotion Worker at Trade Sexual Health in Leicester. We're a sexual health and HIV charity working with underrepresented communities across Leicester, Leicestershire and Rutland. Primarily, we started support with lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender communities, and we're looking at broadening that scope. So the kind of work we do, a lot of the organisation has really been embedded within HIV prevention from our inception in the year 2000. That has HIV prevention work has primarily been targeted towards gay and bisexual men and other men having sex with men. But as we've started to embed our holistic ethos of sexual health, exploring the physical, mental, emotional and social elements of sexual health, we've been able to support the wider LGBT community with other services linked under the holistic remit. For example, things like one-to-one support and counselling around sexual orientation, gender identity, and how that could have an impact on somebody's health and well-being choices. We've always taken a holistic approach to sexual health, and understanding the needs of our community has been one of the things that we've really, you know, thrived upon. Primarily working with gay and bisexual men off the back and continuing HIV epidemic has been one of those things which, you know, never has always been seen from that very, very medicalized model, you know, with infection, medication, etc., but never really fully understood the social impact it had on individuals when, you know, being diagnosed or, you know, exploring ways of preventing HIV transmission whilst also still having a fairly healthy sex life and healthy relationships. And so, you know, following on from that, looking at the mental health impact of gay and bisexual men, both with managing, you know, the best sex with the least harm, as well as living in a society, with, you know, a changing society when it came to, you know, the changing attitudes around LGBT communities and relationships, and all of these different factors merging in to which could have an impact on an individual's choices as to, you know, the sex they want to have, or even assessing that level of risk. If somebody doesn't feel good about themselves, then the more they likely will put themselves at risk because they don't have any care for their own health. So that's why this holistic model of sexual health has really been embedded with everything that we do, in order to help us A, support more people, but also to get people to understand sexual health in a very different light. I guess one of the challenges is the destigmatization of HIV and sexual health across the board, and that's regardless of how anybody identifies. You know, HIV is still very stigmatized in this day and age, even with advancements in technology, advancements in protections in the law for people living with HIV. But once again, kind of trying to shake that British attitude of not talking about sex, or, you know, sex being a bad thing, or sex only being for procreation or recreation. So carrying this rhetoric culturally is quite difficult to then change immediately. So we're kind of, so the way that we focus on it is working with a smaller community where actually the health inequalities are disproportionate, specifically within the LGBT communities, when looking at the sexual health, mental health, and also emotional health of individuals. So as more service users have kind of engaged with our service, we've got to understand more of the complex needs of individuals, but also acknowledging that, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. The LGBT community is diverse within itself. And so we're very much kind of taking on exploring different people's identities, but also understanding what those intersections are with how we can best support them. So say, for example, a cisgendered white gay man who may have a very different experience to that a South Asian bisexual man, or, you know, a Muslim gay woman who, you know, where faith may have an element of impact, as well as gender, as well as sexual orientation. So although when we talk about the LGBT communities, we specifically put an emphasis on communities and not community, because although we are a collective community, which is made up of several different communities based upon the identities that we wish to wear in a particular space, setting, or when we're accessing a particular service. As an organisation and as a service, we're always looking at ways of developing and listening, you know, listening to communities, and when communities aren't being heard, giving them that platform to be heard. And I think, you know, we can't design a particular service targeted towards a community if we don't engage with them to start with. So even when it comes to engaging with new communities that we maybe haven't done as much work with in the past, we need to start with the community first, instead of creating something and then trying to fit them into that particular model, because we know that doesn't work. and by getting that level of community engagement from the onset has really helped us. That, as well as having a diverse workforce in relation to staff and volunteer capacity, because we know that, you know, if we are quite open with how we recruit people within our staffing team, but also volunteer teams, if we can create that diversity from within, that will eventually be reflected outwards too. So it's not always about the change on the outside, but it's about what we're doing inside the organisation too, to help it work both ways. And I think that's one thing that's really benefited us as an organisation, that our volunteer team and also our staff team has always been diverse since our inception. Primarily with South Asian communities, but we're kind of expanding upon that as we go forward to see how we can encourage more people from different communities to enter into this field of work, either on a volunteer capacity or paid work. A lot of the bedrock of our work is embedded with going out into the community, so a lot of outreach work, so going into the spaces where we know the communities that we work with are going to be. So as you've rightly mentioned already, nightclubs, bars, other venues specifically related around sexual health. So we also do a lot of outreach work within sex on premises venues, such as men's saunas, public sex environments, such as cruising grounds, all of which are very historically embedded, specifically within the gay community, as social spaces to meet other men. And that still continues to this day, even with the, you know, even with technology being out there and lots of different ways to connect with other people, still these spaces are very actively used as a way of meeting other men in the context of cruising grounds and saunas without judgment and without, I'd say without fear, but maybe not so much without fear these days, when exploring and having conversations with these men around things like hate crimes, being victims of hate crime, but also how shame and stigma of maybe a man having sex with other men might still feed into preventing somebody from reporting. So actually, when you look at the complexity, once again, the complexities of the communities, by us going out there, we can actually hear these stories and try to take some action going forwards from that. So outreach is very much key to everything that we do. But then other services that we offer then in-house from our base at the trade office, things like rapid HIV testing, you know, getting a HIV result in 20 minutes from a finger prick blood test, counselling services, which we have been able to adapt over the pandemic period to be offered remotely. And then also one-to-one support services too. Well, with one-to-one support services, that's more the practical support. So especially working with LGBT communities, if they're wanting, you know, just some really practical advice where you may not be able to turn to somebody to speak to about, or even look online. So it could be, you know, how do I have sex for the first time as a gay man? You know, what are the things that I need to be doing? LGBT relationships, like what, you know, what does a healthy LGBT relationship look like? Because actually, when we look at portrayals in media, they aren't always healthy relationships which are portrayed. So, you know, some of the practical one-to-one support, that's another thing that we offer in-house. I'm sure there's other things too, trying to think off the top of my head. But in relation to how we've adapted over the COVID pandemic period, we basically had to prevent and stop all of the services that we ran. So especially outreach. And outreach was, like I said, was one of our key services going out into the community. If nowhere's open, we couldn't go out to do any outreach work. Whilst there was an opportunity to do some outreach work online through targeted apps like Grindr, for example, it was still quite difficult for us to be able to engage fully with the communities on a very hands-on basis. As I mentioned already with the counselling service, that was we didn't adapt that to go work remotely until maybe September, October time of 2020. But even then, we knew that some people who wanted to access counselling or who were accessing counselling previously couldn't, now it had gone remotely. And this could be for a whole variety of circumstances. For example, if the individual was accessing counselling because of the space where they're living, accessing counselling in that space wasn't going to be an option for them. So we knew that there were some people that wouldn't be able to access that remote counselling in a particularly safe way. So that's why counselling services was one of our priority services to get up and running sooner rather than later, with COVID secure measures in place. In order to get those COVID secure measures in place, we needed to get funding. So that was one of our priority areas, to get funding to get that service up and running again. And fortunately, we were able to start that before the second wave in the winter time. In relation to other services, we still had an online presence. So although we were working remotely, things like access to, you know, inquiries over email, inquiries over the phone, these were all things that we were able to take, but we definitely saw a decrease in the number of people accessing any kind of informational support specifically around their sexual health. Now, that could have been for a number of reasons. One, the lockdown. If people weren't having sex, there was maybe no sexual health needs there. But at the same time, on research that we'd done later and national research which had come out, people were still sexually active and did break down lockdown restrictions in order to, you know, be sexually active with a variety of different partners. So there clearly still was a need for our services, but if the services weren't running, then there was a gap there. Although sexual health services were able to offer things like postal test kits, where, you know, you could order online, a free postal test kit gets posted to your house, you collect your samples, and then you post them back to the lab to get your results. Once again, for some people, that might not have been accessible for them, especially if they're having sex with people outside of their household. So, yeah, there's a couple of ways that we were able to adapt fully, but even now, I think there's a lot of lessons that we've learned from having to go all online by embedding a hybrid approach to some of our services. So for things like counselling, although we'd never thought about remote counselling before, now we're kind of like, well, it works, why stop it if it's an option which could make counselling more accessible for people? For example, if they can't access the trade space, or people living out in the county, as we're based in the city centre, for people living out in the county, travel may have been an issue. So actually by offering that remote service makes the counselling accessible for some more people. I don't think there was. I think it was all very new territory for everybody when it came to the pandemic. So we basically had to go by what everybody else was doing. And you're right, we did, you know, discuss things with national partners to see what they were doing in their other areas. But literally the restriction was you couldn't get people in or out or really engage with people face to face. So actually when it came to that, it was kind of like a brick wall. And once again, we knew the limitations of engaging with people online. And I know one of the things that became very clear to many people was that digital poverty and, you know, digital exclusion. If people aren't online, they're going to not be included in particular spaces or socially. And, you know, that's one thing we were very mindful of, but we just didn't know how to go about supporting those people without having to break any restrictions of any kind. For me, Building Back Better really is assessing what the situation was before COVID, taking learning away from these 18 months to see how we can actually build a better infrastructure, not just starting from scratch, but, you know, we don't want to ignore any learning from before. But like you said, it is a new world, so there are adaptations that need to be made in a particular way which may have never been thought about. And like I mentioned already with the counselling service, offering remote counselling was just not on our agenda at all. And because of COVID, it made us think twice about not just the counselling service, but also other ways of making our services accessible remotely. And not just services. In fact, even when it comes to engagement with volunteers, a lot of our volunteer opportunities are very hands-on and fell as part of the outreach programme. But as the lead on the volunteering programme here too, I really have to sit down and think, okay, I've got an amazing pool of volunteers who really want to utilise the time that they've got during these 18 months or during the lockdown periods to support the communities that they've been volunteering with. So I then had to sit down and really explore all of the volunteer roles and opportunities which were available to see which ones could be delivered could only be delivered in person, those which could be adapted to also be delivered remotely, and those which could be exclusively remotely only. So the downtime, but it wasn't really downtime because I was still working a lot, but that downtime from usual services gave me the opportunity to then reshape that volunteer program and adapt it in a way which made it more accessible for more volunteers to then come forwards even after the pandemic, but also during the time that they still wanted to give back to the community. So I think for me, it was really sitting back, taking on that learning and actually continuing on with that learning going forwards. The lesson for me would to, even when we're starting new services or any kind of working with new communities, really looking at it from all those different angles. Although I think as an organisation, we were very entrenched in our outreach work and going out into the community physically. But I think part of that then made us neglect that digital side. We really still see the value in the physical element of, you know, being sat face to face in front of somebody or having an intervention with somebody face to face where, you know, there's a lot more signals you can read from somebody as opposed to on a digital platform. But then at the same time, understanding and weighing up the pros and cons of going exclusively one way or the other is something that we don't want to do. And actually going forwards with this hybrid approach of offering in-person option and a digital option, I think is one of the key learnings for us. When a project really has an impact, proving that there's a need for it, how can we continue that, but also not just continue the need, but also fix the issue that started it? So, you know, we can reflect upon food banks, like the need for food banks during the pandemic has really kind of risen. And it's not about how can we continue food banks, it's how can we fix a system that got people to access food banks to start with. So I guess part of that legacy would be to support organisations who are providing that support to then maybe like look at it the other way around. So instead of looking at it as a continuation of a service, reflecting, going, looking back the other way to see actually what do we need to change from the root in order to kind of prevent this service ever being needed. So it's like even with trade as an organisation, we work in HIV prevention. As soon as there's no new HIV transmissions, our work is done for the HIV prevention part anyway. So really all charities are working towards the aim of not existing, because really we shouldn't exist if the system is fixed. I think when it comes to sexual health and HIV, we've kind of seen this as an opportunity to create new partnerships and new links with organisations where actually more things may have come to light than people had ever imagined come to light because of the pandemic. So we're in the process of, you know, reaching out to new partners to get HIV and talking about sexual health and well-being back on the radar for people. This may have just been through conversations that people have had with friends, with families, with service users, but ultimately, you know, if we're starting from scratch, actually building up the knowledge of, yes, it has had an impact on people's mental health, but what other things could have an impact on people's mental health? And then getting people to really understand that holistic idea of sexual health within how we fit and how that might be an angle that people have never explored before. So really empowering people to explore new ideas built because of this, what we've all kind of like started from fresh, or new ideas have come forwards, or people hadn't thought about things in a particular way with supporting somebody solely because they were so engaged with the here and now that actually it prevented people from looking at that wider picture. So for us, it's whilst people are started to look at wider picture of the impacts and the kind of, you know, the domino effect of the different things that could affect an individual's health and well-being, we can include sexual health and HIV prevention as part of that. So we're really looking at it in a much like a trickle-down effect, but also getting to understand as well, like with particular communities, where those health inequalities may impact them more so. So, you know, working with LGBT communities, understanding, you know, the health inequalities which disproportionately affect those communities because of inaccessibility to particular services. So once again, although people may just see LGBT communities as an arm of work, actually no, because LGBT people are still people. If a service is supporting people, LGBT people need to be included within the broader scope of individuals that we're supporting. And actually understanding, yes, there are going to be lots of different people who will have different needs, but looking at them as a person as opposed to just a group of people. Like, for example, if a gay man is accessing if a gay man is accessing something to do with employment and he's also HIV positive, but actually thinking on the back of his mind, okay, do I need to disclose to my employer that I'm HIV positive? How are people going to treat me in the workplace? All these different things they're going to be unique to that person, because as somebody who's maybe heterosexual HIV negative won't have these additional factors to think about. But actually, if somebody, if a service can be open and honest about, if a service can be open and honest with allowing people to be open and honest, they can then tailor that support accordingly to then support that individual as an individual, as opposed to looking at somebody and being, okay, from what I see of you, you're a man, and I'm not going to, and I'm going to assume that you're straight, so therefore you're not going to need to any support of that. So sometimes it's asking the right questions at the right time to be able to tailor that support accordingly. One of the setbacks to that way of thinking that I've explained is also that a lot of people feel it isn't part of their job. It's like, it's not my job to ask these questions, you know. Why should I have to ask this and not somebody else? But a lot of the time, there's just that just identifies a training need for people. If they don't have the confidence, how do we instill the confidence in those individuals to ask those questions? And even when it comes to, like, you know, these monitoring questions that you have around ethnicity or sexual orientation or gender identity, sometimes when people see these monitoring prompts, some people may ask questions. What does sexual orientation mean? What does gender identity mean? And so if an individual has the confidence to be able to be like, oh, well, sexual orientation means this, gender identity means that, you're providing a level of education just off the bat because somebody's unsure about what the question is. But then in order to get to that point, we need to allow people to feel comfortable to be able to ask those questions to start with. And even when it comes, I mean, a lot of people had an issue with asking about ethnicity way back in the day, and I think, you know, even now it's a bit contentious as to which ethnicity should be listed and which one shouldn't, or what is an ethnicity. I had a conversation with some researchers the other day about, should we be asking people's nationality or ethnicity, because it's not, ethnicity is not a true capture of the real diversity of the Leicester, for example, if most people have to just tick white other or Asian other. So because you, what is other, you know? Me personally, but also it's reflective of trade as an organisation, as always being open. So if even, like, we are open to ideas, we're open to change too. And if any, like, if people feel that they're not too sure if our service is for them, either as an organisation or an individual, that there's always an opportunity to be able to talk. And even if we aren't the right people at that moment in time, we would always take the time to seek out and try to find the right people to talk to. We're part of lots of different broader networks, both locally and nationally, so it might be another organisation we signpost to, but actually just having that approachability and openness to be like, yes, we can, and we will try.
You've been listening to Leicester Builds Back Better Stories, conversations about how communities across Leicester are planning for change following the pandemic. For further information about each of the topics covered in this programme and to hear extended versions of these conversations, visit the Leicester Stories website, leicesterstories.uk. Leicester Stories is supported by the Audio Content Fund and was developed with assistance from De Montfort University, the Documentary Media Centre and the Xynthia Trust. Thanks to Ryan Clayton for additional content production. This is a Decentered Media production by Rob Watson.